we go, everybody. This is the TCP, and I am John Stamp. Unfortunately, Tiger Dog is not riding shotgun with me tonight. He elected to chase squirrels in the backyard. Believe it or not, that old dog, he can still get after it. At least he thinks he can. He hasn't caught one in a while, but he's not with me tonight. But you may hear him in the background barking. He's got a powerful bark, that fella. So to get started tonight, I want to, first off, I wanted to ask if you guys saw the artwork that Jeff Hayes at Plasma Fire Graphics did for Wraith of Shelter Mount. Wraith was my experiment in writing a high fantasy novel. It was a blast, lots of research, kind of like living in the real world a little better. But from the start, that was going to be an indie title. I didn't want to get a publisher. I just wanted to put it out myself, see what happens. And so I did. I got the editor, did the cover myself, and it got pretty good. It tested pretty well. And I liked it. I thought it looked good. But when I started working with Jeff to freshen up the other covers on my other titles, I kind of knew that Wraith had to be done eventually. So he nailed it like he always does. So that cover is just wicked. It really spells out the setting. Kind of, if you think of Wraith the Shelter Mount, it's what I kind of, the tone was set as kind of like a Die Hard in a medieval castle. And that, that cover he did, nailed it. And if, I'll put it in the show notes, but I'll also already put it up on IG, Facebook, and Twitter for you to take a look at. Second, I want to continue my wholehearted thanks, for your support for Brothers Keeper and Spoilers, newly added to Audible in the last few months. The comments and the compliments have been fantastic, and I really appreciate it. In that light, I'm trying to figure out what to do next. I've got a few more titles, and as you've seen, I cross genre a little bit here and there whenever the mood strikes me. So I was wondering if you guys would like to see, or I guess listen to is more appropriate, my bad, Way Angels Sing, the sequel to Spoilers. Bianca was such a cool bad guy, and you know, Ben Wilkie had a lot going on. I needed to get that team back together. I wanted to see those two in another book. So I was pretty much, you can thank Bianca for the sequel to Spoilers, and it was a good one. That was a lot of fun to write. Do you want to see or listen to Wraith? Like I said, Die Hard in a Medieval Castle. Basically, I took a whiny, spoiled brat nobleman and killed off his entire guard force and filled his castle up with mercenaries, and figure it out after that. So that was a good time. I've got Shattered Circle and Inquisitor that are kind of a horror crime procedural crossover that I did. So whichever those you guys think sounds good, get it. I said sounds good. Note it. Leave me a comment and let me know what your preference would be. And also, before I get started, Wild Blue still has Blood Red Ivory on sale for $2.99 on Kindle. Throwing that out there. If you haven't read one of my novels yet, the first Ty Benhoff adventure is not a bad place to start. I do really hope that his second adventure gets out this year. He is so far being upstaged by a new character, Billy West, who she has kind of blown his doors off. So that's still working out, still working through some editing, still adding a couple through lines, but I'm hoping that Ty 2 comes out sometime this year. All right, enough about me. Tonight, we're going to talk to Rob Sands. Rob is Iowa's current state auditor and a true crime author. Prior to becoming the state auditor, Rob was Iowa's chief public corruption prosecutor. And while in that position, he uncovered the largest lottery rigging scheme in American history. In his book, The Winning Ticket, Uncovering America's Biggest Lottery Scam, he goes into the book is actually, it not only follows this amazing financial investigation, but also tells how small town America can really sneak up on you when it comes to gaining headlines in the true crime world. It's all the characters. It really comes down to the characters. The Winning Ticket follows this investigation down rabbit holes to uncover how one mild-mannered, very likable man was able to cheat the entire system, winning jackpots over $16 million. He went more than a decade without being caught until Rob got the case dropped on his desk when his boss was retiring. So the winning ticket is it's going to cover this very complicated. I'm still trying to figure out some of the things I've read about it. Financial investigation, one of the biggest prosecutions in recent history. And what's just as fun as digging through and analyzing this crime is looking at the characters that come up in this investigation, from a fireworks salesman to I love this quote, a hoodwinked FBI agent. Can't wait to dive into that one. A crooked Texas lawman, a shady attorney representing Belizeans, and Bigfoot hunters. Yes, I did just say that we have a financial investigation that covers Bigfoot hunting. So yeah, it's going to be a good one. I'm looking forward to it. So Rob, thank you very much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Everything you just said is true.
Yeah, and crazier and crazier. I can't believe it. All that really came true.
Yeah, it's just bonkers. Everything about it is crazy.
What I love about it is that it's one of those cases, and I remember, you know, you set up your desk and the dog case falls on your desk, and
yes,
you know, it's everybody else has been papering it for years, and then it blows up in your face and you have no idea it's coming, and nobody else did either.
yep. And then all of a sudden it's like, hey, wait a minute. That's a great case you got. It's like, yeah, well, kind of. I mean, I've been working on it really hard.
Could have been yours.
Could have been yours. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. So take us through how you ended up getting that.
Sure. So I started at the Iowa Attorney General's office in 2010. I actually came in because they didn't. I was very naive. I loved the idea of prosecuting financial crime. Mostly because I tend to think it's people who sort, it's kind of like crimes against gratitude, if that makes sense. You know, like people who they're not, you know, look, they have access to other people's money. So they have a position of trust in life. They have a position of power and they choose to abuse it to further what they want out of life. And so I have always sort of looked at that and thought that, that sort of stuff both is a little bit, reprehensible in a way that isn't typically appreciated, but also under prosecuted. So I went in saying, oh, I'd love to prosecute financial crime. And everyone in the office is like, great, look at this sucker. Let's hand him everything. Because it's complicated to prosecute. It takes more time. It takes more effort. And at the end of the day, under Iowa law, it also was harder to get real consequences for the people you were prosecuting. Yep. So I came in, you know, young gun, ready to go, wanted to do this stuff, went after it hard, had a lot of stuff that was kind of, you know, good cases to cut my teeth on. The Iowa Film Office tax credit scandal was a great example of that. And then, you know, as my boss, who tried my first few cases with me and got me into everything, was retiring, he handed me this case that kind of had just been around the office and had been kind of a curiosity. What happened was a guy had bought a $16 million lottery ticket. And this was years back, a couple of years back. They went through the claim process. You have a year to claim it from the date of purchase. You know, the Iowa lottery is begging people to turn that ticket in to pay them their money because that's their job. And nobody did it until, well, long story short, there was a guy who clearly possessed the ticket who made a claim, maybe 6 weeks before the expiration of the claim period. But they knew that he wasn't the original purchaser. He claimed to be the original purchaser. They knew that wasn't true, though, because they asked him what he was wearing, and he described himself as he was dressed that day. In addition to that, he gave them his age, and he both what he was wearing and his age did not match the man on the video that they had of the purchaser, which up to that point wasn't public information. And so when they tell them, but yet this guy has the serial number. He's got the serial number that's on the back of the ticket. And so they know he must have the ticket, even though he's lying about having purchased it. So they go out and they say, hey, look, you know, thanks for giving us a call. We're glad you've got something worth $16 million, but we're also curious, you know, why you lied about having purchased it. We know that wasn't you. And the guy ghosts. So now the Iowa lottery is kind of stuck. They're like, well, you know, we'd still like to give this money away, but we can't give it to you since you lied to us, which is technically a crime. And then on the very last day of the claim period, another lawyer, that lawyer had been a guy from Canada, another lawyer from New York has the claim submitted through a Des Moines law firm on the very last day of the claim period. And they say, great, congratulations. They look at who signed the ticket. And it's the first lawyer, the guy from Canada, who had lied. And he's signing on behalf of a trust from the country of Belize. So there's all these red flags. And the Iowa lottery sitting there saying, guys, this shouldn't be that complicated. Just tell us who bought the ticket and, you know, we'll pay you $16 million.
Yeah, that's not a red flag. That's like a dumpster fire.
Yeah. It's a dumpster fire of red flags all on fire. So they go in and eventually, you know, the guy who makes the claim threatens to sue the Iowa lottery. And the Iowa lottery kind of says, hey, great. If you sue us, you know, we'll have a discovery process. We can figure out who actually bought this thing. So they say, go ahead, sue us. And the guy, they call his bluff. He backs down. And the claim expires. And so all of a sudden, there's just this mystery. Who out there will trade their anonymity, you know, for $16 million? Who is it that's worth, their anonymity is worth $16 million to them? And the Iowa lottery, you know, they did their job. They tried to pay the claim. They wanted to make sure the law was being enforced. But they get to the point where there's nothing else for them to do. And so it becomes this criminal investigation that my boss is working on. They go talk to the guy in Canada. He says, yeah, you know, look, I don't know. I got this ticket from these two guys in Texas that I know. They try to go talk to these two guys in Texas. Those guys ghost. And that's about as far as it had gone before it got handed to me.
Wow.
So I, at the time, I'm the low man on the totem pole. I'm the youngest guy in the division by like 10 years. And, you know, my boss is giving it to me because he can, you know. I don't really have the seniority to say no to anything at that point. But he says to me, look, I know you're going to run this out and we're going to do what you need to do to get this thing put to bed. Which is kind of what we, you know, the joke was, you know, it's going to turn out that somebody killed somebody for it. There's going to be a body that turns up. But, you know, the real assumption was that we weren't going to see much of anything out of the case. So he hands me this case and I just start working on the investigation from there.
So that it's funny. You mentioned all that legwork. I mean, the investigators are going to different states. They're interviewing all these people. They've run it down. As you're walking me through this, I can think of a bunch of different justifications an agency could use to kick it, you know? So yep. So it lands on your desk and you just, I mean, what else you got to do? Go start from the beginning. Right. And,
right.
And was it dejecting just reading this, be like, oh, you know, oh, this guy went out and talked to this guy. Well, crap. There was idea number one. Talk to this guy. Well, there was ideas two through five. And I'm like, what have I got left? It was like as you were reviewing the case, when you made your first move, which I imagine you'll go on to in a second, but you almost went back to the wide canvas. Like instead of you had yes. some spear phishing that you could do to get the case moving, all that blows up and you're just like, all right, let's just go back to scratch and start knocking on doors. Right.
Yep. And that's about it. So we had one big thing that we could do that hadn't been done, which was release the video of the purchaser. Now, that hadn't been done because, you know, as soon as you release that video, you're going to have, you know, 200 people who look like the purchaser knocking your door down trying to get $200. And it had been very useful to screen claims. Somebody walked in and said, oh, yeah, I bought that ticket. And you knew what the purchaser actually looked like. You could look at the video of the purchaser and say, yeah, no, thank you. No, he did not. Yeah. So, but we hit the point where there wasn't anything else to do. So we set up a SurveyMonkey to take tips from the public and we put the video of the purchase out on the internet and just say, hey, if this is you, if this is somebody that looks, if this looks like somebody you know, sounds like somebody you know, please tell us who. We would like to figure out who this is. And One of the first interesting tips that we get is from a guy in the state of Maine. We're in Iowa, you know, so it's kind of weird to have a interesting tip come all the way from Maine.
That's a lot of reach.
But yeah, but it goes to motive. You know, that question, who would prefer their anonymity to having $16 million? Well, the guy who's sending a tip in from Maine is this guy, Mickey Boardman. And he says, "Hey, I work for the lottery for the state of Maine. And I know that guy. That guy is Eddie Tipton. And Eddie Tipton works for the Multi-State Lottery Association." And so all of a sudden we're like, it's interesting. Eddie Tipton had gone to Maine twice, each time for a week, working side by side with Michael for a week, trying to make sure their games were secure. And so we get, I think, two other tips from people who know Eddie Tipton personally, who send in a similar tip and say, "That's Eddie Tipton." All three of them, by the way, identify him not by visuals, because it's a little bit of a grainy video, but actually by his voice. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And so we go.
Yeah. Upside, go ahead. Go ahead.
We go interview Tipton, and you know, he denies having been down in Texas, he says he was down in Texas at the time, but says he was there visiting friends, doesn't name any of his friends, just says, you know, that's where he's from, which is pretty big coincidence that he had to go down to Texas around the same time, but says he wasn't there on that day. That's the day he was still in Iowa. And you know, just basically denies everything. But then we figure out his job, actually, at the Multi-State Lottery Association is writing the program that picks the random numbers.
That's
just crazy.
That's funny.
Yeah. Yeah. That doesn't smell right. So we get into that, and, you know, eventually we are able to, we subpoena his bank records, subpoena his phone records. We can actually put him in Iowa on the day that the ticket's purchased. And we know we're running up against our statute of limitations. So we indict him. And then we got to start working the investigation against the clock, starting to try to move more quickly.
Yeah, that was, when I was reading, though, it was almost, it was funny, the comments that were made by these people who all in different times saw this video, and they were all like, "No, that can't be Ed." Like, he's the office like snuggle bear. Like, he's just a nice guy that's always around the office that just wants to make people happy. You know, he's not like the wearing the black hat and like sneaking around the corners. He's not the bad guy. He's just Ed, right?
He's a big, nice guy. Yeah, like big dude. But nice guy, tells people when they have a tough day, "Hey, I'm your friend." You know, just, yeah. I mean, honestly, aside from quite a bit of thievery, not a terrible person.
Yeah, you mentioned the statute. I don't know what it is in Iowa. When I've worked, most of the frauds I've worked, there's a five year clock from the last action, whatever that action may be. When people think of criminal investigations, they think, you know, if it's a homicide, there's often no statute of limitations. Assaults, maybe 15-year statutes. But the trick with working fraud is it's a records chase. It's a people chase. And you are on the clock. You're behind the clock before you even know you have a case. So so it speeds you up. So can you explain you get the indictment, but then you got to build a case. So it's, can you go into how that works?
Oh, that's exactly right. That's what was so tricky about it, because, you know, most of the time while we're investigating, we didn't even really know what crime we were investigating. And so we didn't know from where that clock might start ticking. In Iowa, under Iowa law, it's a 3-year from the last action statute of limitations. So basically, you've got to figure out what happened and indict somebody within 3 years of the last thing they did to further their effort, to further their criminal actions. And if you don't do it by then, time's up, you're too late. And so we just didn't know, you know, what we were dealing with until we figured out what that Eddie was involved and that Eddie had purchased the ticket. And there were two statutes that we could charge him with that seemed pretty clear. So we did. Both having to do with passing a lottery ticket with the intent to deceive. And so we hit him with these charges. We try to do it within what we think would be the last act in furtherance. And we win those appeal, or we win those motions in court to be able to maintain the case, to keep it rolling on their attempt to dismiss for the statute of limitations question. But then here's the crazy thing. In Iowa, you have a so most folks know under the U.S. Constitution, you've got a right to speedy trial within 1 year. In Iowa, you have a right to speedy trial within 90 days. And so when we hit that indictment, it was a sprint, because we had basically identified Eddie. We had disproven his alibi as to where he was. And that was it. We had almost at that point very little else to go on, but we knew we had to get an indictment going, and we knew, you know, we thought that that was enough. It was a bare bones case. It was a sufficient case. It was ethical to file it at that point, but we also knew we still had a lot of work to do. And for the first time in my career, Eddie Tipton worked to push us on speedy trial. He did not waive his right to speedy trial within 90 days.
Wow.
And so we are just absolutely under the gun, sprinting to try to get this whole thing figured out, while also litigating what the facts are and litigating whether or not what he did is a crime, while we're investigating the facts and the circumstances. So it's just a really complicated 90 days. We get right up to the cusp of trial. We actually go in on that day to start trial, and his lawyer tries to exclude most of the evidence that we produced. Just says, no, you shouldn't allow this. This isn't fair. You know, it was provided to us too late by the state of Iowa. We're like, well, you know, we got it organized so that you would know what you're looking at, and we gave it to you. And the judge said, no, I'm going to let it in. And then once he lets it in, then they say, okay, I want a continuance. So they ask to postpone trial. And the judge says, okay, you can have a continuance to look at the evidence. 2 or 3 days later, he reasserts his 90-day right to speedy trial. So then we still, again, have this 90-day clock that starts to tick again. So it was just it was such a complicated, fast-paced investigation. We get into these crazy rules like, I'm blanking on what it was called now, but I'm getting ahead of myself here. This is when we still only know about one jackpot.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
yeah, because we go to trial basically knowing that Eddie, you know, we have these two really heated 90-day segments of investigation and litigation. We go to trial. The national media, I think it was CBS This Morning, says, you know, there's a really good argument for a lack of proof here that he really did it, but I'm able to get a conviction, and then we kind of, you know, we're waiting for the pre-sentence investigation to hit. We've offered him a deal where we could make a better recommendation for him at sentencing if he would tell us everything that happened. And so while we're waiting to hear that, I get this phone call. And at this point, I recognize the number. It's the Texas area code where he's from. And this, I answer the phone, and this guy with his Texas drawl says, "Y'all know Eddie Tipton's brother won the lottery maybe about 10 years ago." And that was when we were really just off to the races again. You know, just, oh my goodness, this is what we've been, you know, waiting to have an opportunity to dig into. It wasn't just one ticket. There's more out there. And now we're going to have more time to keep investigating.
Yeah. So, yeah. And I don't want to cut you off, but you said a couple times, investigation plus litigation in this 90-day package.
Right.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but when I've seen that, I don't know how your office worked, but I'd imagine if that was floating around the office for a while, is it consistent to say that you know, in the afternoons, you're in the war room directing the where the investigations, the leads, and how the analysis goes. And then the next morning when defense calls, you're defending your actions that very recently took place. Like
more or less.
So you're defending yourself and investigating in just a rotating basis. I don't even know how you keep track of all that.
Yeah, no, that was more or less it. And it was very difficult. It was very complicated. I had a full caseload beyond that, all the other cases I was working on. It was just a crazy time, but it was also fun. It was exciting, you know. Yeah. As we get in further to this case, we realize, you know, we go back to that hoodwinked FBI agent, the guy that really helped us on this getting the second jackpot, which was actually crucial for our ability to go to then all the other state lotteries, nearly all of America's state lotteries.
Wow.
And say, hey, you need to help us with this. We really needed that second jackpot that was struck to be able to say to them, like, hey, there's more out there. And it was this FBI agent that really did that. So we were talking to this guy who with this Texas accent who called in this tip. And he says, well, you ought to talk to the sheriff down here. Okay, we call the sheriff. And the sheriff says, well, you ought to talk to this FBI agent. And it's this guy down in Texas named Richard Renison. We feel a little bit like we're getting passed around. You know, oh, talk to this guy. Oh, talk to that guy. But, okay, sure. So we call Richard Renison. I tell him, hey, you know, look, a prosecutor up in Iowa. Well, we got this case with this guy with a lottery jackpot. And people are telling us we need to talk to you about it. And he goes, oh, you're talking about my Bigfoot case. And of course, I'm like, no, sir. This is a case about a lottery jackpot where someone won millions of dollars. He's like, no, that's my Bigfoot case. And I'm just kind of sitting there like, oh, okay, sure. What about Bigfoot is related to the lottery, right? And he goes on to tell us this story. He gets a tip one day that a justice of the peace in Texas is trying to launder money. This justice of the peace has hundreds of thousands of consecutively marked bills. And he's going to this fireworks dealer trying to get him to trade some of his cash for that cash. This fireworks dealer is like, sure, let me think about that. And then, you know, runs and calls the FBI because that's what a good ethical person does. Yep. When a lawman wants to, you know, trade dollars for dollars. So the FBI shady. Gets involved. Yeah, super shady. The FBI gets involved, and Richard Renison's the case agent on this. And they go in and they're trying to figure out, they verify, you know, what's going on. They verify that this guy Tommy Tipton is doing this. And they go and interview him. When they interview him, no kidding, he's sitting in the hospital bed because he had fallen out of a tree while hunting for Bigfoot.
That's awesome.
Just stuff, you know, you can't make this stuff up. But so they've got a captive audience. He's not going anywhere. And they're like, well, hey, what's going on with you trying to trade these dollars? And he gives them a story. He says, yeah, look, I won the lottery. I don't want my wife to find out about it. You know, maybe we're on the outs. I don't want her to know about the money in case we get divorced. So I asked my friend to claim it for me. And I'd give him a little piece of it if he did. And they go and talk to the friend, tells him the same story. Sure enough, the friend is listed as a winner of a Colorado lottery jackpot.
Wow.
And so they're kind of done. They look, because you know how money laundering works. Money laundering isn't, you can do what you want with your money as long as you have obtained it legally.
Yep.
Money laundering is only a crime when you have gotten the money illegally. And so since Renison runs down this money and sees that it's from a Colorado lottery jackpot, at the end of the day, he's like, all right, man, like there's better ways to hide this money from your wife, but this is the lottery money. You're not committing a crime.
Yeah. You think she was going to be expensive.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. There were some better options here.
There were better options. Yeah.
Much, much better options, but that's where it went. And that's how we got there.
So did he actually find Bigfoot or did he just fall out of a tree?
There's a funny story about that. They later interviewed him again. Renison later interviewed Eddie Tipton or Tommy Tipton, the Justice of the Peace again, because they wanted to make sure they were doing this when he was not in the hospital and not potentially under the influence of any narcotics, right? Prescription narcotics, obviously, due to his pain. And he brings into the interview this plaster cast of what he says is a Bigfoot footprint. And allegedly, the story goes, he pulls it out at the end of the interview and shows it to him. And Renison goes, well, it's not that big of a foot. and Tommy Tipton goes, it was a juvenile, and like snatches it away and puts it back in its bag.
That's, yeah, but he so, probably also wrote a blog post on some Bigfoot site that he's working with the FBI to solve Bigfoot now.
He probably did. But it's just, you know, and this is like, you know, we've been going here for what, half an hour, and this is just a chunk of the stories in this case, which is, you know, there was a certain point, and one of the things I personally like about the book, it's my first book, maybe it's my only book, but there was a point in the investigation where I said, I got to start writing this stuff down. And it was less that I was thinking it was going to be a book and more just like for posterity. I grew up in a small town in Northeast Iowa. You know, we always sat around the table with my aunts and uncles in my grandparents' house, you know, swapping stories and telling stories. And I wanted to be able to remember all these stories to tell people, you know, kind of just the same way my aunts and uncles and my grandparents and my parents used to do. And then I hit a point with all these crazy twists and turns where it was like, I looked at the word count in that file one day and I was like, man, this could be a book. And there we went.
That's awesome. That's sorry, excuse me. But so as I'm reading through this and as you're explaining it, as far as chase and evidence go, I mean, so Ed is the basically the InfoSec guy. He's the information security specialist keeping the integrity of the system as the coder. So he's the guy who wrote all this code, right? To secure the lottery.
Yes. Yes. That was his job, writing the code.
And it's 13 different states, and all these states have their own machines because Ed went to Maine to work on the machines with the first guy who turned him in.
That's right.
And so part of this, I would think, would be we need to get the defense forensic, the digital forensics guys in here. We need to start digging through stuff. Was that a possibility, or were A, the machines updated, or B, was the lottery commission like, you are not looking at my code?
No, and that's what's really interesting about this. So the machines that had pulled those IO numbers had been wiped clean as per standard operating procedure. And so when we only knew about the IO ticket, there was nothing to look at. The machines that had drawn that code had been destroyed long, long ago. But as the investigation grew, as things expanded, then we saw, okay, hey, wait a minute, there's, you know, the Wisconsin lottery. Joanne Joy and David Moss up in Wisconsin were wonderfully helpful. They identified a lottery that Eddie Tipton's best friend had claimed under an LLC. And they still had, in fact, the computer that drew those numbers. And so they hired a computer expert, Sean McClendon, who was actually then able to effectively reverse engineer that code and figure out what exactly it was that Eddie Tipton had done to make those lottery jackpot tickets predictable.
Wow. That's I can't even imagine, because he said, I don't know, what did he say? It was called some tiny little piece of a code or something like that.
It was really only 16 lines of code. That's all it took.
Yeah, out of millions. Then that guy's right, able to find it. That's the crazy thing. It makes me wonder though. You're investigating in the afternoon, defending yourself in the morning for what you've done in the morning, you know, the night before. How much research did you have to put in so that you could speak intelligently about the code, the random number generators, the algorithm?
Oh, yeah.
Did you just say, I got an expert for that? Or were you just like trying to keep up?
You know, so I think this is really interesting. And to me, the easiest way to understand this is it's almost analogous to the development of DNA technology. You know, it used to be that back in the day in a murder case, if you had DNA evidence, you were going to have somebody on the stand for a day, right? Talking about the science behind DNA and why everybody's DNA is unique and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Going through all the science. And now you don't do that. Now, when you've got DNA evidence, you have someone go on and you say, you know, is this your profession? Yes. You look at DNA for a living? Yes. Does everybody have unique DNA? Yes. And does the defendant's DNA, you know, what's the probability of the defendant's DNA being there, right? And here it is. And was it a match? Okay. And it's a 5-minute direct, right?
Yeah.
There was a point where I wondered how much I was going to have to talk about this. And this was actually one of those like 2 a.m. wake up and your brain has solved the problem things. Oh, we're going into trial and this is before we have, because when we go to the trial, we only have the Iowa ticket. That's the only one we've got. And so when we go to trial with just the Iowa ticket, I'm sitting there thinking like, how am I going to explain to people like how this worked? And then I realized that everybody knows that technology works, and we're sort of with technology and with computer coding, we're at an advanced point where we are with DNA right now, where you don't have to tell everybody exactly how it works and exactly what happens. They just understand from the circumstances that it works that way. And so that's what I did. And it was effective enough that I actually got I write about this in the book. I got a little giggle during my rebuttal argument from one of the jurors with one of the points I was making. So it was pretty straightforward at the time. And then, you know, when we really did get into it, once we did have them nailed and we had all that code, at that point we had, you know, 6 jackpots, we had the code, and he ended up pleading along with his best friend and his brother.
Wow. Well, yeah, and I want to get into that, but before that, I don't want to forget, but what you just said is kind of a very interesting comment on the state of juries at this point in the game.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a corollary. Wow.
Corollary. It's a tough one.
There we go. That's a tough one. I would hate to give something like CSI like props for something, but when you were saying that, that's all I can think of is, you know, 20 years ago, you put an expert on the stand to explain DNA to a jury. It's going to take days, right? And then we get freaking 15 years of CSI Vegas, Miami, New York, LA, Mars. And
yes,
suddenly everybody's like, oh yeah, it's DNA. I know how that works. I've seen it on TV like a bunch. So, and so
that's
I guess
right. That that's right.
Along the same path. Yeah. Everybody knows computers work, and everybody knows, you know, this it's programming. The files are in the computer. That guy just said so. So it's,
that's right.
An interesting statement on the common education of the people who end up on a jury, you know?
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. I mean, people just, they get to the point where like, yeah, I know what DNA is. I know how it works. You know, I watch it on CSI. I learned about it in my high school biology class. Like, can we move on? You're boring me, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That's funny. What was the giggle you got? What'd you laugh about?
Well, so the defense attorney in his closing argument is trying to say, you know, this is all just a guess. We're just all speculation, you know. And my response to that at the end is like, look, you know, we know this stuff works. You don't need to understand exactly why. When you type a message into your phone to your spouse and you hit a series of letters in a specific order, you don't have to know precisely what happens, but you know that somehow those messages are literally beamed into space and then beamed back down only to your spouse's phone. And it's going to be in the same order, so they're getting the message that you want, right? And you know this happens because of the circumstances, because you have sent and received so many text messages throughout your life. And when you put a CD, it isn't even new that technology, that we know how technology works even when we don't. You know that when you put a CD in with the Rolling Stones, it's not a miniature Mick Jagger in the speaker, right? That's going to start singing you a song. You just know that you hit number 5 and it's going to play the 5th track. And you know there's some grooves on the bottom of the CD, whatever. But I don't need to understand exactly what is happening to know what the result was. And so that's the same thing here. If somebody is writing the code that picks random numbers, allegedly, for a lottery jackpot, and they just so happen to be identified as the purchaser of a $16 million record-sized jackpot for this game, and then that ticket just so happens to be claimed by someone who got it from the, who just so happened to get it from the best friend of the person who works there, you know, you don't need to know precisely what it was that he did to know that he rigged it. You just know he rigged it from all the circumstances surrounding the rigging.
Yep. Yeah. Nice. And then she was like, ha, you nailed it.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I mean, that was it. And we had a guilty verdict. And then again, you know, that's when it was really off to the races, because that was just the Iowa ticket. And from there, we went to Colorado, Wisconsin, Oklahoma, and Kansas with all these jackpots. Yeah.
Man, so how much was it all together?
I was afraid you'd ask me that.
I think the Iowa one was 16, right? The Iowa one.
Yeah. 16. Yep. I think the face value of all the tickets all told was about $22 million. Now, the amount that they actually got was a lot less than that, because they took those, you know, single value payouts, those one-time lump sum payouts.
Yep. Yep. That's my plan too when I win the Powerball, but I'm not cheating, so it's taking longer than I thought. So you get him, you get his brother, and who were there other people, or was it mostly him and his brother and his best friend?
We've got to talk about the Bigfoot hunters.
Sorry, I didn't realize that you were muted. I was like, oh, I lost him.
Oh, I apologize. I am trying to make my son's dinner. I am doing some solo parenting this week. And they're going to have one of them's got basketball in a little bit here. So if you hear me doing stuff in the background, it's me making peanut butter. And if you leave that in for the edit, that is just fine by me.
Oh, I get that, man. Yeah, it makes it, it's real.
Real life sounds in the background. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it makes it real. I like that.
Yeah. So hold on a second. What was your question again? I'm sorry.
So we got Eddie, we got his brother. And then
the Bigfoot hunters.
Friend. Oh, the Bigfoot hunters. That's right. Bigfoot hunters.
So Eddie, obviously, he's the mastermind here. He's writing the code. He knows what's going on. He knows what he's doing. His brother claims parts of the is involved in the claiming of the Colorado jackpot and the Oklahoma jackpot. Obviously, if you're involved in the claiming of two jackpot tickets, you know what's going on.
Yeah.
Right? His best friend is involved in the claiming of the Wisconsin jackpot, as well as the routing of the Iowa jackpot ticket. And there are some funny stories in the book about how he got involved and what his reaction was to Eddie getting him involved in the Iowa ticket. But so the three of them, they all very plainly knew that what was happening was illegal. They knew that Eddie worked, they knew who Eddie was. They knew he worked at the lottery. They knew what his job was, and they knew what was going down. They were in on it. The Bigfoot hunters, different story. There were people involved in this who were, I guess a term, you know, a technical term for it that you would appreciate would be like a useful idiot. You know, someone who is doing something that they are happy to be doing, that they might have some benefit in, but they don't actually know the bigger scheme beyond what is happening. And so that's the people who were not prosecuted, because at the end of the day, they too were lied to by the Tipton brothers. And so they would hear things like, hey, like Richard Renison. I mean, not that he was in on it in any way, but these people would hear the same story that Renison heard. Yeah, look, hey, I got this winning lottery ticket. I want to claim it, but I don't want my wife to know about it because, you know, we're on the outs. So look, if you claim it for me, I'll split it with you. I'll let you have 15%. And so, you know, look, to a normal person, what you're describing does not sound illegal. It doesn't sound like a crime. It sounds sneaky, but it's, you know, someone else's sneakiness. And hey, I'm going to get a bunch of money. So the folks who did that with each ticket were involved at that level. we used them as cooperating witnesses, but we didn't indict them or charge them because we didn't think that they had any criminal knowledge of what was happening. And there wasn't any evidence to suggest it, really.
Yeah. It's funny. While you were talking about, you got Eddie, brother, and best friend. As you're laying that out there, I'm like, man, these guys needed some Smurfs. I put it back.
That would have been
back to the drug
yeah.
guys.
You're like, yeah. Guys,
and then you're like,
no, you're exactly Smurfs. Right. They should have had a lot of people buying these for them. Although yeah. I'll tell you, the way Eddie wrote the code, he only knew a predictable jackpot was going to hit about once a year nationwide. And so the circumstances were rare enough that, I mean, hey, he had it going for 10 years. And of course, then his mistake was to purchase one by himself, to do it himself. And you talk about all-time boneheaded moves.
Yeah, he had a good game going.
He had a great game going. If he had not made that mistake, maybe he'd still be out there doing it now. But it was when he was directly identified because they had the video of the purchase. That's when that's when the jig was up for him.
And did he mention why? What most of the time when these organized enterprises fall down, it's because there's either pressure or there's time or the planning fails. So it's like, did he have something fall through where he had no other options? He had to go do it.
You know, he never got into that. Honestly, at the end of the day, I just think it was classic overconfidence.
Yeah.
He thought that, look, I mean, they had the first time they ran this thing, they had the FBI sniffing around and the FBI didn't figure it out. So I think he just had over. I think he was just overconfident. He thought, I've got a great thing going. No one's figuring this thing out. In the book, we get into the Kansas jackpots. It's a similar story in Kansas. He's purchasing them himself.
Wow.
Two jackpots, two tickets. But he's just, he thinks he's got it made. He thinks he's home free on this stuff.
Yeah, there was that quote where you plant a money tree in your backyard and it's kind of hard to stay away from it, right?
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah, man. So that's interesting. It's they say the smart ones aren't the ones you catch, but he had a great game going and you just get a little too full of yourself.
That's right.
I did have a question about that first one. So the one in Iowa, he goes in and buys it, and then you get right to the threshold. You get right to that year limit before people start sniffing around. Did he ever mention if he like bought it and won it, and then he was like, well, he was like a dog that finally catches a car. He's like, now what? I was just wondering.
What we got into with that was really, this makes sense to me. I describe it in more depth in the book. But what he says is, I bought the ticket and I gave it to my buddy, Robert Rhodes, who had already claimed that Wisconsin jackpot. So he was already in on things. He knew how it worked. And I said, hey, man, we got another one. You should hit this claim. And he was thinking that Robert would be willing to do it on his own. Robert was not. I get into some more interesting details about that in the book. He was very much not interested in making that claim on his own. And so it sort of sat there. Eddie says he didn't know where it was going or what was happening with it. But eventually, that claim came in. And it still traces back to him because he's passing it with the intention that it get claimed.
Yep.
So at the end of the day, if you're putting a hit out, same thing. You're putting a hit out on somebody, you may not know ultimately the identity of who's fulfilling the hit, but you're the one who put it there.
Yeah, it's your idea.
That's right.
Yeah. Yep. So, that's just that. I just love the fact that you guys, this thing's floating around forever and everybody's like, hey, just figure out a way to close this thing,
Yeah. Yeah. And then boom, we're off to the races.
Yep.
And, there were a couple of different occasions too, where we tried to get the feds involved, tried to get them to take the case. That's really interesting too, because for different points at different reasons, they didn't want it. And then when they did, they put some strings on it that just didn't make sense as strings to be attached to actually having them do it. But yeah, it's just a wild story. The book's a winning ticket. You can get it pretty much anywhere.
Yeah, it's a good read. I highly suggest it to everybody. It's most of the time on the true crime side, you're talking about dark and grisly, and this is just that it's that the thing is
that's right.
The bad guys, you're like, well, they're thieves, but everybody, the people turning him in were like, it can't be Eddie. He's too nice a guy. Right.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
So that's just an interesting twist that these are like good old boys that are just like, yeah, well, it worked. He's like, who was it? The guy in Office Space that decided to just add a zero. Was it Michael yeah. Bolton? Michael yes. Bolton's like, and then they go to check the ATM. He's like, holy shit.
Yeah, that's right.
I believe this. No, works.
It's true. Like if you can have a feel good true crime story, this might be it. It's not a story, there no one, thank goodness, no one's life is ended, no one's bodily autonomy and freedom is violated, and the people who were stolen from, they had a chance stolen from them.
Yeah but they were gonna win anyway.
It's just a very interesting story. And the other piece of it that I get into a lot in the book is I had a genuinely good relationship with Eddie. He and I are both from small towns. This prosecution, because it went through a trial and then a subsequent investigation, it went on for a few years, lots of depositions. We kind of got to know each other pretty well. I had a better rapport with him than I've ever had with any defendant before. I got along with the guy well, and I think some of it had to do with the fact that we both were just kind of, kind of small town kids from out of the way places who were working on this thing together.
Yep. Yeah. And it's funny. It's, people always think that we got to be at like loggerheads with the people that we're prosecuting, and they're just right. People. They're just in a different line of work.
Yes.
They're probably bad guys, morally reprehensible, but you can have a cup of coffee with them, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, Eddie and I, we shared a couple jokes. We talked about musicians, but yeah, I mean, it's humanity, man. I mean, that's what you get to see when you're in this line of business, is everybody that you want to say bad guy to. I was just making dinner for my kids. My younger son asks me a lot about bad guys. What about the bad guys out there? Bad guys this, bad guys that. And I answer his questions, and then I remind him. But keep in mind, buddy, everybody can do good things and everybody can do bad things.
Yep.
And we like to tell ourselves, that they're so different. But yeah, you can. You can have a cup of coffee with them. They're children of God, just like you and me.
Yep. Yeah. Everybody starts in the same place. There's a lot of variables along the way that lead down paths. I know you got to get to basketball practice, but I did. There was this one part where Eddie's going into sentencing and he decides to tell the judge. Yeah. He's during sentencing. He decides to make a point of telling the judge that he's taking classes to join the ministry. And I just had to ask, because I've been at enough parole hearings and sentencing where how many in all those follow-ups, the appeals, the sentencing cases, how many times have you seen somebody suddenly show up with a Bible and they've never mentioned it before in their life?
Yeah, so many times. Yeah. It's the easiest appeal. I don't remember who said the quote, but somebody said it, when somebody starts talking about that, they reach for their wallet to make sure it's still there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've had that. I had a sovereign citizen before pitch the judge on the investment scheme that he had invested all these people's money in, trying to tell the judge, "Oh, don't worry, we're about to get the money back." You find true believers of a lot of different forms in court on judgment day.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember seeing how many people that just suddenly find it. They find that faith right when they're up against the wall.
That's right.
But Rob, I'm gonna let you go because I know you got stuff to do. But thank you so much for reaching out to me. This is a great story.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for having me on. Again, the book's The Winning Ticket. Thank you for having me on, folks. If you're reading it and you have questions too, You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. It's Rob Sand IA.
All right. I will add that to the show notes, everybody. And you can get a winning ticket at it's on the links will be in the show notes, and it'll be on Kindle and all that good stuff. So Rob, thank you very much for joining me, and reach out anytime, man.
All right. Yep. You too. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, everybody. We'll talk to you next time.